Making contact.
I'm Amy Gastelum. You're listening to Making Contact. Today, we're revisiting a story we first published in 2023. It's about criminalized survival, or how survivors of intimate partner violence become entangled in and punished by the criminal justice system.
And I was like, wait, like, we're putting women and survivors in prison for fighting for their own lives.
That's journalist and survivor Natalie Patillo. Together, she and cinematographer Daniel Nelson made the award-winning documentary film, And So I Stayed. We interviewed them last year, and today we're sitting down with Natalie again. There is a lot to catch up on. A lot of it is good. Stay with us. I'm Amy Gastelum. You're listening to Making Contact. Today's show is a powerful story of solidarity and response to the problem of intimate partner violence. Please take care when you're listening today. Now to our interview with reporter Natalie Patillo. Hey, girl, hey.
Hey.
So, Natalie, just to recap for our listeners, your film, And So I Stayed, follows three women's stories, Tanisha Davis, Nikki Adamondo, and Kim Dadu Brown. All were sentenced to many years in prison after actions they took to protect themselves from their abusers, which resulted in their deaths. The film follows these women, but it also follows the fight to get a law passed in New York that would give hope to people like Kim, Nikki, and Tanisha, who have been incarcerated after surviving domestic violence. It's called the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act, or DVSJA. Can you summarize what the DVSJA does?
The DVSJA allows judges to look at domestic violence as a significant contributing factor to a crime. So it works in two ways. Folks can be sentenced under the law, which means less harsh sentencing. And then it can also be used for folks who are currently incarcerated, and the crime predated this law's existence. So then they're able to potentially get out earlier than their original sentencing.
So Natalie, in your film, we learned that Tanisha was able to use this law on appeal to get her sentence reduced, that retroactive sentencing we were talking about. And so the third woman in the film, Nikki Adamondo, was tried and sentenced after the DVSJA passed. But here's the thing, the judge in her case didn't really seem to consider the new law. The judge sentenced her to 19 years to life in prison, which is like not a reduction at all. And so in the end of your film is really heartbreaking because Nikki is still at Bedford Hills and her sister Michelle is raising Nikki's kids and fighting to get her sister's sentence reduced. But a lot has happened since then, right? For one thing, Nikki is out.
Nikki is out. The case thankfully went to the appellate court, and the appellate court did think she was eligible. So they were able to use the law in Nikki Adamondo's case and say, actually, she does qualify. She is eligible for the DVSJA, and she did get a sentence reduction.
Right. So now that Nikki's out, she has been advocating for laws similar to the DVSJA. Here's some audio from an Instagram post that she made with her sister, Michelle Horton, in March. They are cozied up on the sofa in their living room.
As you know, the only reason I'm home right now is because of the DVSJA. So a law passing like this in Oklahoma would have the potential to help hundreds of incarcerated survivors.
And the survivors in Oklahoma really need this. We were told that Oklahoma has the highest rate of domestic violence in the country and also the highest number of incarcerated women. Obviously, those two things go hand in hand. So what we need to do right now is to encourage Oklahoma senators to say yes to Senate Bill 1470.
Okay, so update here to this Oklahoma law, girl. It passed. So how did it feel to watch this law pass in Oklahoma?
I mean, honestly, of all states, like, to be frank, it just doesn't come to mind as like Oklahoma will be next. But the organizers in Oklahoma have worked very hard
So I talked to Alexandra Bailey to get some more information about this. She is a senior campaign strategist with the Sentencing Project. They advocate for effective and humane responses to crime that minimize imprisonment and criminalization of youth and adults by promoting racial, ethnic, economic, and gender justice. Okay, so Ms. Bailey, who is also a survivor of domestic violence, has been working hard on this Oklahoma bill. And she said what really motivated her to pursue this law was a Mother Jones article she read about a case in Oklahoma highlighting failure to protect laws, which is one of the ways that survivors get entangled by the criminal justice system, right? Can you explain failure to protect laws?
Right. So a survivor could be with a partner who is abusive. That abusive partner could cause harm to a child. And just because the survivor might not be able to leave or was just present whenever the abuse took place, those failure to protect laws can cause these survivors to be criminalized. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense, and it'll never make sense to me.
Well, you're not the only one. Here's Alexandra Bailey talking about the Mother Jones article that she read.
And it highlights one particular case about a woman who was in a terrible domestic violence situation that could have taken her life. And her children attempted to intervene. And one of them got pushed out of the way and hurt themselves. And she went to prison for that. And the even more ironic part is that, or terrible part, I guess I should say, is that her children were given to her ex-partner, who had already spent multiple years in prison for committing domestic violence against her.
It's baffling. Utterly, it doesn't make any sense.
You can't, it's like you eat too much ice cream and your brain no longer functions.
So this was 2022, and in this Mother Jones article, Alexandra saw Colleen McCarty's name. She's the executive director of the Oklahoma Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. They connected, Alex secured funding, and together they created a coalition to write a law that used New York's DVSJA as a template. The coalition included representatives from tribal nations because Oklahoma is Indian country. That means that there's various legal conditions to consider. And it is worth noting that Indigenous American women are the group that experiences the most intimate partner homicide in the United States.
And the great thing is that we've been in lockstep with incarcerated women from the beginning.
Word. So they had a few false starts in the legislature, but in the end, Alex told me that this bill
flies through the state legislature. I mean, just flies. It goes through committee, unanimous vote. It goes to the other committee, unanimous vote. It gets to the floor of the Senate, unanimous vote. It transfers to the floor of the House, 3 no votes. Unheard of in Oklahoma.
Were you surprised?
At those numbers, at unanimous in Oklahoma?
Right.
I don't think you could get a unanimous vote on saving the dolphins.
My mom's people are from Oklahoma, so like,
yeah.
I noticed that part of the new law, just like New York's DVSJA, says that there has to be a high burden of proof. Mm-hmm. And this has been an issue for survivors. So the latest National Domestic Violence Hotline survey showed that of survey respondents who called the police for help with a domestic violence incident, almost 40% actually felt less safe after calling the police, and that 12% of respondents never even called the police in the first place because they're afraid the police will take their kids or end up arresting them or deport them or make a violent situation worse. This fear of police is disproportionate for Black and Brown women and immigrant women. So requiring evidence, including police reports, to use this law.
It doesn't have to be a police report.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a police report.
Okay. What else is included in that burden of proof?
Hospital reports, first person witnesses of abuse can be used. So there are, like, you know, if you had a therapist or you did an outcry to somebody, you know, that is, you know, all things that can be used. We just filed April Wilkins' case in Oklahoma. It's a 425-page document of just witness after witness and testimony after testimony and doctors and, you know, police reports and rape kits and restraining orders. So it seems like everybody knows about it. It was crazy.
And yet, I mean, I just want to point out that even though April Wilkins is a white woman with mountains of evidence, like, I'm still on pins and needles to see, is this law going to do what they say it's going to do? Because if you look at Nikki Adamando's case, too, in New York, like, it all came down to that judge the first time that she tried to use it and she still got sentenced to years in prison.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's in New York. And I'm like, okay, Oklahoma, like, let's see. Like, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, am I on pins and needles? Mm-hmm. Of course. But what I will say is that from the very beginning, we've been willing to go to the mat on this issue. If I have to come back and change the law again and get another avenue, I will. But, you know, it's one of those things where I think what they're starting to understand is we're never going to go away.
Mm.
And there are a lot of women in your state and they vote.
Yeah.
And they don't want their daughters to die.
Right.
And they don't want to die themselves. And they don't want to spend the rest of their lives in prison.
All right. So, Natalie, Alex said that they are starting with 13 cases. April Wilkins is the first. You've heard of April Wilkins, right?
Yes. Yes. I have heard about her case. Definitely.
She's got a lot of media attention, so I'm not surprised that you've heard about it. After April, 9 more cases will be released at the end of September. So that's what's happening next for Oklahoma. Meanwhile, Alex is headed to Louisiana to work on a similar bill there. And she said if anybody listening wants to work on a bill in their state, she is here to help.
We do have a model DVSJA bill with recommendations. And, you know, if you want to go down this rabbit hole, I will jump in the hole behind you.
Okay. So, Natalie, we've been keeping an eye on Oklahoma and this bill, and you even gave a showing of your film, And So I Stayed, at Tulsa Community College not long ago. How did that go?
The showing at Tulsa Community College was wonderful.
So one fan of your film wasn't able to make it to your showing, but she had already seen it because she rented it on Vimeo. And that is Amanda Ross, April Wilkins' niece. Amanda has been advocating for her aunt for about 10 years. She was only 7 when her aunt was sentenced to life in prison after she shot her longtime abuser, Terry Carlton, soon after he had handcuffed, beaten, and raped her. And I asked Amanda how she got to know her aunt, April, given the fact that she was in prison when Amanda was a child. Here's Amanda.
She would call my mom every Sunday, and I was eavesdropping the whole time, but it was every Sunday that was like the day we knew to expect a call from her after church.
Okay, so Amanda said that besides these weekly phone calls, she and her aunt sent letters and eventually emails back and forth. She said April was really caring and just a really sweet person. And she never mentioned her case and always asked about Amanda's life. Growing up, Amanda's family supported April. But the message that Amanda got about what happened was kind of confusing.
Even the narrative that my parents would tell me, like even as a little kid, was you know, she wasn't treated fairly by the system, but there was still this undertone that my parents believed she still did something wrong or wasn't as right about things as she could have been. And I think that that comes from living in the Bible Belt and just judging women. And that's not something that I stand for. And that's also something like I've had a lot to unlearn. I'm 34 now and I'm still unlearning.
Back in 2014, April asked Amanda if she could make some copies for her. She was planning to try to get her life sentence reduced, but she needed some clerical help. And Amanda had access to a copy machine, so she made the copies. And on those papers that Amanda copied, she saw April's own account of the abuse she had suffered over the course of several years with Terry Carlton. Amanda had never heard the full story up to that point, so it was shocking and heartbreaking for her. She said around the same time, a producer named Dave Randag made a YouTube video of a recording April had taken of a conversation between herself and Terry. And in it, Terry admits that he beat her, that he raped her.
Hearing him admit it on tape, that was a turning point for me. And so as I was starting to question, you know, how bad was it, that came up. It's kind of funny because when you're in it, like when it's your family, you don't think to even Google things.
Because you think you have the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't hear that until my 20s. And I don't think my mom and dad had heard it either until recently. But it wasn't played at her trial either. Like, I don't think the jury got a full picture. I know the jury didn't get a full picture.
Amanda said that all of that paperwork, that copying her aunt's story, it did not do anything. April's sentence was not reduced. That was 2022.
So yeah, that was very disappointing. But right around that same time is when Colleen and Leslie entered the picture too. So it really took off. It was like a domino effect after that.
Colleen and Leslie are lawyers with the Oklahoma Appleseed Center for Law and Justice, a leading force in the coalition that Alex Bailey mentioned.
And they didn't make any promises. They were very clear, like, we don't know if we can help your aunt. And she said, if we can't get April out, we can maybe help other people.
Given everything you're saying about all the unfairness that you witnessed firsthand from the state of Oklahoma, were you surprised at how kind of efficiently the Oklahoma Survivors Act, like, went through the process?
I didn't expect it, for sure. It's very weird, but looking back, Oklahoma is weird. We
stop there.
Like, we don't fit normal stereotypes sometimes. How we have tribal governments that have to interact with Oklahoma, and Oklahoma also is very into those stand your ground laws, you know, and self-defense, but it didn't seem to work in April's case. So why doesn't it seem to work for women? But yeah, I think that this just speaks also to the fact that there's a domestic violence problem in Oklahoma that affects everyone across party lines. And at this point, I'm wondering who doesn't know someone who is incarcerated at this point because of our high incarceration rate.
What's April's response to this act becoming a law been? Like, how's she doing?
I think this is the first time she's seen the finish line, so to speak. Like, it's given her and others a lot of hope. I'm excited to turn it over to her, like this narrative, like I've been posting online for her on social media, and I'm excited to let her like drive the boat, so to speak,
on her own story. Yeah.
Hey there, I'm Lucy Kang, reminding you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233 or text the word BEGIN to 88788. Their website is thehotline.org. Okay, back to the show.
I'm Amy Gastelum. You're listening to Making Contact. We are back in the second half, again talking with reporter Natalie Petillo. So, Natalie, remind me, what year did you start reporting about criminalized survival?
In 2015, Amy. So, oh my God. Yeah. Like,
that's been a while.
It's been a long while.
It's been a long while. And I remember, I mean, because you and I go way back.
Yeah.
Like, full disclosure, you and I go way back. But I do remember that at the time you were really frustrated because there was pretty much no data, no numbers to stand on in terms of how many people were incarcerated for actions resulting from IPV situations. And I know that as a journalist, having data is everything. You cannot report on what isn't proven.
It was really frustrating. It was like, here is this issue. that I am hearing through my reporting isn't anecdotal, isn't like, oh, a one-off, isn't something that happens sometimes in one community. And I'm like, well, where's the data? There was nothing for me to look at on a national level of how often this was happening.
Well, guess what, girl? They did it in California.
I know.
They did that. They actually went through everything. As you know, Stanford University's Criminal Justice Center launched the Regilla Project a few years ago. And so this group of faculty and students has conducted a research project to better understand exactly this, criminalized survivors of intimate partner violence.
I'm Debbie Muckamal, and I'm the executive director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center.
She told me that back during COVID lockdowns, they had invited the journalist Rachel Louise Snyder to talk about her book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Well, Debbie told me that Rachel had the same exact complaint as you, that there was no data on criminalized survivors. And so that really fired up Debbie and David Sklansky, the faculty co-chair, to take some action. And they were like, we can do that. Like, we can get this data. So here's Debbie.
And very quickly, we brought Andrea in as a gender violence expert.
I am Andrea Cimino. I am the director of research for the Regilla Project.
So, Natalie, Andrea told me that they invited all of the people in California women's prisons who were incarcerated for manslaughter or murder to participate in this study. So they ended up surveying 625 people. And because of the way that housing is done in prison facilities in California, they included cisgender women, trans women, and trans men. And so the Regilla Project, they did not rely on court documents or letters in the mail for this survey. These were face-to-face interviews. So here we go. Here's the big number. They found that a little over 74% of the people surveyed scored positive for intimate partner violence in the year preceding their arrest. 74%. Wow. That's almost 3 out of 4. How's that hitting you?
I'm not completely surprised based off of the reporting that I've done throughout the years, mm-hmm. the stories that I've heard throughout the years. It is heartbreaking. It actually makes me really emotional.
Yeah. Well, and I wanted to include this piece from Debbie that is a bit of a caveat.
You know, we started the study with the question, how many women are incarcerated for killing their abuser? And we thought that that was the approach that we would take, really trying to hone in on where the decedent was, the intimate partner. But what we quickly realized in designing the study was that that approach would be too narrow. And we needed to include everybody, no matter who the decedent was.
Here's Andrea.
So women who killed their child, women who killed strangers, even had histories of intimate partner violence and were in potentially lethal relationships.
I just also want to emphasize that we should be careful with the language. Women who are responsible for the killing of someone. Sometimes they were not the people who actually committed the act, but they were legally found responsible for the killing of someone. And it's an important distinction to make, particularly when you get to coerced killings, when you get to aiding and abetting liability, that includes failure to protect children and the like.
Are your findings from California generalizable across the country?
We have no reason to believe that they are not generalizable. In fact, we believe that things could be more stark in other states, given that California does have included in our legal paradigm different accommodations for people who have histories of intimate partner violence in our evidence law, in our parole law. And so we believe that the findings would be the same, if not higher, in other jurisdictions.
Like any study, some of what they learned surprised them. And to be honest, it surprised me too.
So at least 16 people talked about the abuse was so bad, I started to self-medicate with drugs and alcohol. I then got into a driving-related accident and I killed a stranger. So we need to go back. Where does that come from? And how does the intimate partner violence relate to the stranger being killed in a DUI?
you keep pulling that thread and it comes back to the home. And it's in so many homes. Did I read this right? That's some statistic that showed like half of women in the United States will come up against IPV at some point in their life. Is that ringing a bell, Andrea? I know you're going to know.
Yeah. Little less than half. Around half in their lifetime. Yes. And we found 10 times as much in this group of women compared to national statistics.
Natalie, so what else is new? What else is there to report? I know that you have some presentation coming up. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, there's some exciting screenings coming up. New York State Unified Court System. They're asking me to talk to them about my experiences making And So I Stayed. And they knew I was a survivor, but they didn't know that I had fought to protect my own daughter in that very same system, the New York family court system. Mm. And I can't quite put into words what that feels like, other than this is kind of what I wanted the entire time, was like, can I just get everyone's attention, please? Can I just get the judge's attention? I just want to explain what it's like to be put into our shoes, where we have to put a child to sleep who is scared that they might have to visit an abusive parent. So when that came across my inbox, I still can't believe it. It's like full circle. And that will happen in November.
Thank you for sharing that and just being vulnerable with us. And I have to say, like, as I'm listening to you, that like so many people I've talked to for this episode particularly have shared that they have some relationship to domestic violence themselves. And I am really, personally, I feel very like heartened about the kind of coalition building that has happened among survivors to make something happen.
Absolutely.
There's a thread there. There's definitely a thread there. The passion of what it means to reclaim power from systems that would have us not have it. If you want Natalie to come and present her incredible, moving, award-winning film in your community, or your school, or your prison, how can people find you, Natalie?
They can find us through our website, which is andsoistayedfilm.com.
Well, I condone rest and, doing softer things like gardening.
Yes, yes. I just picked off an heirloom eggplant that's orange.
What? Orange eggplant? I'm into it. It's very cool.
So that's kind of my life right now. it's like the end of season. So I need to figure out what my winter joy is. Yes. And we all do, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I'm Amy Gastelum. You've been listening to Making Contact. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233 or text the word BEGIN to 88788. Their website is thehotline.org. If you want to learn more about any of the groups or advocates you heard about in this episode, you do not need to frantically write down everything you're hearing. Just go to our beautifully updated website, focmedia.org, where you will find links in the show notes. Until next week.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Teach my children about systemic racism.